ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit leggmason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime. As always, I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. So I have three excellent guests set to join me this week. I'm going to start with ETF.com's Drew Voros. He has the latest ETF flow numbers in hand. These are through November, hot off the press. Drew's going to walk us through where ETF investors have been putting their money this year and how that compares to prior years. And then I also have several fun rapid-fire questions to throw at Drew, including on cannabis ETFs and zombie ETFs. So we'll start there. I'll then be joined by Rich Powers, who's head of ETF product management at Vanguard. Of course, Vanguard is the country's second largest ETF provider. And when you talk about ETF flows this year, one area where we know investors have been putting money to work is bond ETFs. And as it turns out, the top two bond ETFs in terms of flows are both from Vanguard, the Vanguard Total Bond Market ETF and the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF. So we'll discuss both of those with Rich. I have some, contrarian questions on both of those ETFs, which I think you'll find interesting. And then we'll also discuss what's been going on in the brokerage world with everyone going to commission-free trading and Schwab's purchase of TD Ameritrade. And I'm going to get Rich's take on non-transparent ETFs, which I've got to tell you, I'm highly interested in hearing Vanguard's perspective on that. We'll then close the show this week with one of my favorite ETF resources, CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. And I guess sort of sticking with a theme here, Todd will recap ETFs in 2019, which I know for a fact he's going to talk about bond ETF flows. But I'm also going to ask him for his favorite new ETFs this year, his favorite ETF ticker symbols, and then we'll look ahead to 2020 and get some ETF predictions from Todd. So fun show. Questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com or you can find us on Twitter at etfprime. Let's start this week with ETF.com's Drew Voros.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I think we're seeing a different way of ETFs being launched. The real kicker was governance, selling of private data. They really let down their customers repeatedly.
Drew, so you cover ETF flows as closely as anyone, and you do have the latest numbers in hand. Give us an update. Where do we stand with less than a month ago in 2019?
Well, first, Nate, happy holidays to you and to the audience.
Thank you. You too.
And in that theme, let it snow, let it snow. I'll say let it flow, let it flow. we're seeing, as usual at this time of year, we're seeing a wave of demand, but really we're on pace for what we had last year. It's going to be very hard to top 2017's 476 billion total flows for that year. We're right now at around, you know, last year's pace of 265 billion. So $40, $50 billion in December is not out of the question. That would still take us, you know, well below 2017. But the real story, Nate, is fixed income flows, as you have alluded to. For the first time, I think, we will see by the end of the year, fixed income flows will surpass equity ETF flows. And that's across the board. Combined both U.S. and international in both asset classes. So this is the first time that we'll see that. Not only that, all through the year, month after month, we've seen some pretty strong flows into fixed income ETFs, despite the fact that equities are at all-time highs. So it's been very interesting. I think there's a lot of reasons to that, particularly the fact there's a lot more fixed income products out there. We're seeing negative demand or negative yields around the world. And there's just a little bit of caution out there that markets or stock markets are at a very they continue to hit all-time highs. And the idea that you put some money in fixed income is not a bad idea, especially with rates going lower.
Yes, so I guess, Drew, does that surprise you at all? And I'm going to ask Vanguard's Rich Powers this as well. But to your point, stocks are up over, 25%? And here we have bond ETFs leading the way. You know, can you offer any context around that? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's always draw when you're at all-time highs, and that's always a smart place to put it. But I also think that with rates going down, negative yields across the globe, people are just putting money there. And again, I don't have this number in front of me, but there's just so many more fixed income products in the ETF space now compared to 5 years ago. I'll take JP Morgan, for instance. They have a whole new suite of fixed income products that have brought in billions and billions. So we're seeing, just more out there. So I don't think this is going to be an outlier. I think just it is the way that people are now going to invest when they are thinking fixed income. And there's, again, you have short-term, mid-term, treasuries. Anything you want is available.
Anything else on the flows standing out to you this year?
I just think that it is interesting, again, not to repeat, and you're hearing all the fixed income flows, and I think it is a trend that's going to continue. A couple other things. One, looking at the asset classes, inverse funds, which is usually ETFs that are shorting something or betting against something, have seen $5 billion in inflows, which doesn't seem like a lot, but it is almost 50% more than it was a year ago. So I think you're seeing people still have that. There's a sense there that things are going to start going down, but frankly, they haven't. And as they say, the trend is your friend in both fixed income and equity. Performance is there and demand is there.
Going back to bond ETFs, I know you were part of the Inside Fixed Income ETFs conference a few weeks ago, I believe out in San Diego?
Yes.
Just curious, anything noteworthy come out of that?
I think what was noteworthy, and you hear a lot of talk at conferences about ESG, and ESG was a topic on a lot of fixed income panels. But what I thought was interesting, it wasn't just this is the thing people want to hear. What I heard is a lot of institutional investors, a lot of investors are asking about ESG. And so there is a response out there now of, and I think it's just an overall mindset in the corporate world that these are important metrics to take into account, and investors are asking for it on a large level, too. We haven't quite seen the demand and the flows, but if you look at Europe, it's huge there. I think it's just a matter of time, and it has to be the right product. And there is an understanding for the retail audience that isn't there yet. So time will tell.
We're visiting with ETF.com's Drew Voros. Okay, Drew, so let's switch gears. I thought it might be fun to hit you with a few rapid-fire ETF questions. I don't think you and I have done this before, so I thought it might be fun to mix things up a bit. And I actually want to start with a piece you wrote fairly recently on cannabis ETFs, where you talked about how challenging the market environment has been for the five new pot ETFs that have come to market this year. Unfortunately, really bad timing, right? Pot stocks have been absolutely bludgeoned this year. Any thoughts on this space moving forward, whether you look at individual marijuana stocks themselves or just looking to the marijuana ETFs?
Well, it all looks, how you want to slice time. At one point, MJ, the largest $1 billion marijuana ETF, was phenomenally performing. And this year, the table has turned, and a lot of it is just to do with the market. The underlying securities for these ETFs are very thin. There's not a deep pool for it. And those securities had really been inflated, 18 months ago or so, when Canada was legalizing. There is a more and more mindset across America accepting this. And so there was an expectation, sort of like back in the dot-com days, the extrapolation of what could be didn't necessarily happen as quick as the market may have wanted it to with the valuations. So we're seeing a pullback. And the new products that came out, hit when they did. I don't think this is a fad in any way. It's just, again, something that's going to take time, and there just needs to be more security so it's not as volatile in that space.
No, I agree. I don't think it's a fad either, but certainly when you launch new products, you like to have the tailwind of the market. And we've seen before when thematic ETFs launch, if there's something in the news that really resonates with that particular theme, that can be a launching pad for that ETF. And it's just interesting that, I thought this was one of the ETF stories of the year earlier in the year, having these five pot ETFs come to market. But man, it's just been it's been tough sledding.
Yeah, and there's a select audience that's going to buy that too. So that's also something to keep in mind.
All right, next question I have for you. You had a tweet last week that this caught my attention. You said that zombie ETFs don't die. However, you found one that is going to die, the AGFIQ U.S. Market Neutral Size ETF, ticker SIZ. I guess first, do you want to explain what a zombie ETF is? We haven't really talked about that on the show. And then any quick thoughts on SIZ? What's going on here?
Sure. Well, a zombie ETF is sort of something that's been around that nobody seems to use or trade, has very little AUM, and for some reason the issuer keeps it. Maybe it's a bespoke product and somebody's money, or for whatever reason. And we used to see this a lot with the old Barclays commodity ETNs. Like there'd be a lead ETN or a tin ETN and no trading, but it'd be around and around. So it was a tool for somebody. But they have seemed to go away, and sometimes they pop up. If you will, and the fund is called AGFIQ U.S. Market Neutral Size Fund, which is a very difficult brand to understand right there. Ticker is SIZ, and ironically, Nate, the last day of trading is next Friday the 13th, December 13th, and we call them zombies because they exist, but they don't seem to go away. And this launched back in 2011 as $800,000 in assets under management. And according to our fund reports, it tracks an equal-weighted index with long positions in small-cap U.S. stocks offset by short positions in long-cap U.S. stocks from a pool of the largest 1,000 stocks. So, I mean, it's just confusing. It's complex. It's not for a general investor. But it is closing. And the good thing is that somebody doesn't walk into this because the spreads are huge. As you know, when something isn't trading, going in and out, you're going to pay a lot more than just an expense ratio and a commission.
I know there's no formal criteria for a zombie ETF, but do you have any sense as to how many of these are out there right now, just roughly speaking?
No, I don't. I mean, I would say something under a couple million in assets that's been around over 5 years that doesn't trade. And if you look on our fund reports, you can see what we see a flat line in terms of spreads. People aren't trading. When somebody trades, they pop one way or the other. So that's the real danger. Somebody thinks that they stumble upon an ETF. They're like, oh, I want to invest in lead, for instance. And then they go in and out, and it doesn't usually end out well.
Do you think this is as simple as the fund companies just hoping that, these ETFs can gather some assets and get off the mat? Or what do you think?
No idea. I mean, the issuer is AGF Investments, which I've never heard of before. It's the only ETF they have. Whatever reason they put it out there for, I don't know. Why, and they won't speak to that necessarily.
Okay, so let's go opposite of a zombie ETF. Give us an ETF that, in your mind, has proven the test of time, right? So what's an ETF that you feel like investors could put in their portfolios, forget about it, feel good about it? It's not going to turn into a zombie ETF.
Yeah, well, I mean, the obvious choice is very conservative vanilla S&P 500 fund. The market's up almost 25% this year. I mean, I don't know how much more people expect out of their investments. So I always think that's a smart one. to start.
So
what,
like something like SPY or IVV?
You can get it from Schwab for 3 basis points. I mean, you could really find something basically almost for free across the board and any of the major issuers on an S&P 500 fund. But one other fund that, if you talk about, you know, want to play the market and forget about it, you know, just have something there. I like SPYD, Spider Portfolio S&P 500 High Dividend ETF. You're basically buying SPY and you're getting some dividend in return. Again, I don't own it. I'm just throwing that out there as sort of an enhancement to a S&P 500 vanilla ETF.
Okay, last question for you. In my conversations with you, you're a very creative person, and I've been asking everyone this recently on the podcast, do you have a better name for non-transparent ETF, something a bit more, we'll say, marketing friendly?
I sure do. It's called active. I want to keep it simple. You know, we just talked about fixed income ETFs, but we didn't go down through every slice and grain of what they are. I think for the general investor and for a ETF podcast, sure, we can call things whatever and everybody understands it, but it's a hard concept for people to understand in the general investor audience outside the Wall Street world, what that really is. And active is just the way we're slicing it now. It's just a different reporting cycle for different ETFs. Some do it every day, some do it every quarter. And I think that if we just start there and say, look, here's a new twist to active ETFs that you haven't had before, but here's the difference between that and this. I think that's a really better way to start than just create these new terms. And that's the problem with ESG. You ask somebody on the subway what ESG is, and they think it's a food product or something. So I think we have to stop inventing terms and make it simple for people to understand.
No, I think that's a good point. I mean, if you look at the investment space, we have way too much jargon out there as it is, right? Too many acronyms. I guess my only pushback on that would be, do you not think there needs to be any distinction between transparent and non-transparent active? I just wonder if you lump it into active ETFs, you know, maybe the end investor doesn't realize the distinction there. And maybe, you know, we'll see what happens. Maybe that's not that important, right? Mutual funds only report holdings every quarter. So is that what it boils down to? You just don't think it's that big of a deal?
I don't think it's that big of a deal. And the other thing, too, when you see a fund's name, it doesn't say, you know, in the fund name, hey, we report every 30 days or every day. It requires the investor to look at what they own when they report. And when you start saying non-transparent ETFs, people are like, whoa, what does that even mean, right? And maybe you and I understand it, but I really get concerned that when we start creating new terms, it just creates a wall of understanding. And all we hear at conferences is education, education.
Right.
Let's make it simple. Let's stop creating things that people need to learn and make it easy for people to understand.
Unfortunately, I have a feeling non-transparent ETFs is going to stick unless somebody comes out with something really good. I just think that term, it's been used so much over the past year or so, it's going to take a lot to supplant it. But I guess we'll see.
Drew, you know, and I think it's also inside baseball term.
I agree. So. Hey, fun conversation this week.
Yep.
Great stuff as always. Appreciate you joining me.
Thank you for having me.
That was ETF.com's Drew Voros. Our next guest is Rich Powers, head of ETF product management at Vanguard. Of course, Vanguard is currently the country's second largest ETF provider. They offer 80 ETFs, and actually earlier this year, they crossed over the $1 trillion mark in terms of ETF assets. That includes over $200 billion in bond ETFs, which is what we'll be focusing on this week. Rich is on the line with us from Pennsylvania. Rich, always a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, good talking to you again.
So, Rich, one of the biggest ETF stories this year has been, without question, bond ETFs. And we're closing in on about $140 billion of net inflows into bond ETFs in 2019. As I'm sure you're aware, if that holds, that will break the full year record of $125 billion set in 2017. And we should also note that the $140 billion is more than has gone into stock ETFs this year, which I find that interesting, just given the year we've had in the stock market, right? The S&P 500's up around 25%. I guess to begin, what's been your take on bond ETF flows this year? Are you surprised at all? Does it make sense to you?
Yeah, I think this speaks to just the growing maturity of an acceptance of fixed income ETFs as a tool for advisors, institutions, or retail investors to access the bond market. So as you well know, fixed income ETFs were launched 10 years after the first equity ETF. And so there's this natural kind of lag in terms of adoption, but I think we're seeing the early stages of that. I think the other things you have to be mindful of, too, is there's probably a lot of rebalancing happening, right? With equities doing so well, investors rebalancing to a target asset allocation towards fixed income probably is helping fixed income ETF flows. You can't ignore the fact that there's geopolitical and economic concerns around the globe, and so investors may be wanting to lessen their risk. And then I think the last thing is bonds are actually performing really well. If you just looked at the total bond, U.S. total bond market, it's up almost 9% on a year-to-date basis. International bonds are up almost 8%. So everywhere you look, be it equities or fixed income, returns have been good. Across our entire AD ETF lineup, every one of the products we have has produced a positive return so far this year. That's a really unique phenomenon.
Rich, to your first point, when you look at the growing use of bond ETFs, do you think it's just taken a while for investors to get comfortable with bonds in an ETF wrapper? And now, you know, maybe we are getting to the point where investors are more comfortable, they're becoming more educated, and they realize ETFs can be a pretty good way to access bonds.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of skepticism. Certainly we encountered that over the years around investors saying, well, wait a second, you have fixed income instruments that don't necessarily have a ton of underlying liquidity in and of themselves, and then you're putting them into a wrapper, the ETF structure that offers second-by-second liquidity. I think investors have come to appreciate that actually the existence of fixed income ETFs has added liquidity to the fixed income market more broadly. And so I think now that concern has been overcome, investors are saying, wow, there's lots of utility, there's benefits from a cost and efficiency standpoint to use a fixed income ETF than, say, building a bond ladder.
Okay, so if you drill down into the detail under bond ETF flows this year, as it turns out, Vanguard actually has the top two bond ETFs in terms of inflows. Number one is the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF, ticker symbol BNDX. That's taken in over $10 billion. And then number two is the Vanguard Total Bond Market ETF, BND, with over $8 billion. And I thought I might take a bit of a contrarian approach here and just ask you about some concerns I've been hearing on both of these. And maybe we can start with BND, which tracks the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. So one question I have for you is, there's been a lot of talk about how because of the shape of the yield curve right now, investors might be better off just staying on the shorter end, right? Because you can scoop up the same yield as something like BND without that duration risk. Any thoughts on that? Obviously, with the flows into BND, not everyone feels that way, but this is something I've been hearing more and more of.
Yeah, I think a couple things you have to be mindful of if you do that. One, that type of decision requires kind of ultimately two actions. One is to what's the right time to allocate from intermediate term bonds, which effectively is the exposure you're getting in BND, to a shorter term bond fund. And then ultimately, when do you reallocate to a more neutral stance from a duration standpoint? We know, just based upon the last 10 years as an example, there were lots of expectations around when yields would rise and that they would kind of rise to a certain level. And the timing around that was super, super difficult to pin down. Yield stayed much lower for longer than was anticipated. They rose and then quickly declined. And so I think investors trying to time that to pick up that extra yield, you know, they may be harmed in the long run. I think the other thing to point to here would be that you move in on the yield curve, you're probably not picking up the same yield. If you are, it's probably because you're taking on more credit risk. So just to use two products in our lineup as an example, so our BND has a yield today of around 2.25%. In order to get a comparable yield at the short end of the curve, you'd have to use our short-term corporate fund, VCSH, which offers around the same amount of yield. There's a different risk profile there. You know, the VCSH is almost 100% corporate. BND has maybe a third of its assets in corporate. So it's not like for like, and I think if investors are considering that, they'd want to think long and hard about those two points around timing and then the risk profile.
Okay, so on the note of credit risk, another concern I've heard with something like BND is the increase in triple B rated debt. And, you know, if you look big picture, I think the concern is the weighting of corporate debt has increased. You mentioned, you know, close to a third. And then that corporate debt quality has theoretically gone down. Any thoughts on that?
It's funny, Nate. It wasn't too long ago when investors were pointing to BND or other broad market fixed income funds and saying there's too much exposure to treasuries or agencies, and now the narrative has flipped to say...
I remember those days. Wasn't that long ago.
Exactly. I think we have to be mindful of a couple things. So one, say a broad market fund like BND has less than one-fifth of its assets in triple Bs. And then two, we have to remind ourselves of what type of rate environment we found ourselves in and why companies made the decision to maybe issue more debt and take advantage of those low rates. So, you know, when you think about coverage ratios and other type of financial metrics that highlight the exposure of the triple B companies, the quality that they have today is materially different than they were before. And the right decision for many of those companies was to take on more debt rather than issuing equity. And so, you know, as we think about kind of the credit environment, our fixed income group is remains constructive, though cautious, and is quite selective in terms of how they build active fixed income exposures.
What about considering active management in this space? So I would say this is yet another thing I've heard more and more of, that because of the two things we just discussed, you know, some would say maybe an active manager could better navigate the bond market right now. Perhaps they could scoop up more yield with less duration risk, maybe avoid lower quality corporate debt. What's your take on active management in the core part of a bond portfolio?
We're big believers. We offer both active and passive fixed income exposures. And I think really it depends upon the investor's risk tolerance and what they're ultimately trying to achieve from an investment objective perspective as to whether an active strategy could better serve them relative to an index product. Fortunately, at Vanguard, our active products and our index products are very low cost, and so that decision is perhaps a little bit easier for someone to make. But certainly, cost is a big component when thinking about whether going active. And then, honestly, just genuinely looking at the risk exposure that the active strategy has. It may benchmark itself to a Barclays Bloomberg Aggregate Index, but its risk exposure, be it curve or credit quality, may be materially different. And so its outperformance may come from factors rather than true skill.
Our guest is Rich Powers, head of ETF product management at Vanguard. Rich, let's switch gears now and talk about the Vanguard Total International Bond ETF. Again, this has taken in more money than any other bond ETF this year. What do you see as the investment case? Because again, if I just play devil's advocate, I think some investors see the negative interest rates around the globe, especially if you look over in Europe, and I think they wonder what the point is of owning these bonds. So what is that case? Why own something like BNDX in a portfolio?
Sure. I think it's really about diversification. If you look at the benefits of holding a non-U.S. fixed income exposure to complement your U.S. fixed income exposure, you're getting benefit to many more yield curves, sector exposure, sectors, a quality mix that's different from that exists here in the U.S., and you have to remind yourself that the role of a fixed income allocation in a total portfolio is to be a ballast in more rocky times. We know the volatility of equities, and fixed income has a different volatility profile. Within international, it's really important that you think about whether that portfolio is hedged or not. If you left your fixed income exposure unhedged, I think you're introducing more equity-like volatility to that portfolio, and so that's the reason why BNDX is a hedged international fixed income exposure, because you're allowing that portfolio to behave like investors would expect it to, which is providing diversification but lower volatility.
But just given where rates are at around the globe, I mean, how much of a concern do you think that should be to investors if they are looking overseas and they understand removing the home bias, adding some diversification? But again, you look at where rates are at, I mean, should that be a concern?
So investors, when you think about a hedge portfolio, you're capturing kind of the delta between the interest rate in the local market relative to that in the U.S. market, along with whatever the local yield would be. And so you're picking up some additional return or return that's more like the local fixed income marketplace. Granted, it's not exceptional. You look at BNDX's current yield, it's 50 basis points, but its risk profile is materially different than any other than equities by a wide margin. And so if an investor is thinking about diversification and keeping a lower volatility exposure in their portfolio, it can still serve that need, even if yields are very low.
And by the way, we should mention that last year, Vanguard launched the Total World Bond ETF, ticker symbol BNDW, which actually owns both BND and BNDX. Do you want to briefly comment on that?
Yeah, so we long offered global equity portfolio for investors to have a one-stop shop of the global equity market cap, that's VT, but we didn't offer a global fixed income product, and so we'd heard from a subset of our clients that they're looking for kind of a one-stop shop for getting that global exposure so they don't have to do the rebalancing themselves. BNDW allows them to do that, and the underlyings, as you mentioned, Nate, are 49% BND and 51% BNDX as of the end of last month, and so that allows the investor to get exposure to those two products in a single ticker and have a exposure to 15,000 bonds in a single ETF.
Is that just weighted by the market value of the underlying bonds themselves?
That's exactly right. And so those figures I shared are as of the last month. Those will fluctuate depending upon the performance and the issuance in the U.S. and non-U.S. markets.
Rich, before we move on from bond ETFs, I guess to sort of put a bookend on where we began the conversation, I saw a stat last week that in 2005, there were only 6 bond ETFs on the market. And if you look today, we're well on our way to, 500 bond ETFs. What do you think the future looks like for bond ETFs? I'm assuming you expect this growth to continue, but are there specific areas of opportunity or certain channels where you expect this growth to accelerate?
We're really constructive on future adoption of fixed income ETFs. Maybe kind of a way to frame it is if you looked at the global fixed income marketplace, only about 2% of the assets that are invested in the global fixed income market are invested in a passive form. About half of those are in ETFs, half are in mutual funds. And so in terms of the adoption, acceptance, and development of indexing, particularly in ETFs in fixed income, we're barely getting started. And so I think there's lots of room for growth there, which is, in stark contrast to equities, where I think the case for indexing is clear and you see that reflected in cash flows. I don't think that day has really come for fixed income, but I think it's around the corner as investors think about the benefits of the lower cost and the efficiency that fixed income ETFs offer.
I know you're not going to give us a Vanguard's playbook in terms of some potential ETFs that could be in the hopper. I know you're very meticulous with your launches, but as you look at the bond ETF space as a whole, are there certain areas where you see some white space where, again, you do think there are some areas of opportunity?
Yeah, I think so BNDW is probably a perfect example of where we saw white space. BNDW is the only global fixed income index ETF available in the marketplace, which is kind of stunning given the fact that there's 2,300 products in the marketplace. However, there's not as clear place to, in terms of white space, but I think there are other places that could benefit from Vanguard bringing a fixed income offer to those categories, and we'll spend a lot of time thinking about that in the months and years to come.
All right, Rich, before I let you go, there are two other ETF-related stories that I'd love to get your take on while we have you on the line. And I guess first, any thoughts on what's been occurring in the brokerage space? So a couple of months ago, we saw all of the major brokerages go to commission-free trading, which, by the way, I do think it's important to point out, Vanguard obviously helped initiate this, right? You offered nearly every ETF commission-free last summer in 2018, which I think was a major catalyst here. But, last week we saw this news that Charles Schwab is buying TD Ameritrade. How does any or all of this impact Vanguard's approach to ETFs? Do you view this as good, bad, and different?
I think the elimination of commissions is fantastic for investors. It really allows them to keep more money in their pocket. I think, two, it actually simplifies the decision-making process for investors. Historically, they might have had to consider whether they wanted to buy an ETF on a platform that charged a commission versus one that might be commission-free. And so it's simplified that decision-making for an investor, and that's always a good thing. And certainly for Vanguard products, it certainly has been a positive development. As you noted, we have offer commission-free products across the industry for more than a year now, and now that our products are also commission-free on all the other platforms is great for the investors who want to use our products. I think one thing that's kind of been a narrative that's been in the marketplace that we would dispute would be eliminating commissions somehow causes investors to act against their own best interest. We were able to look at the behavior of our investors a year before we eliminated the commissions and a year after, and the behavior was identical. I.e., they didn't trade more because the commissions went away, and we know that trading a lot is usually a bad thing for investor outcomes. And so we're very positive that this will lead to just better outcomes because investors will have more money in their pocket.
Do you think that's maybe unique to Vanguard's customer base, just because, of course, your philosophy has always been to focus on the longer term? So do you think maybe that lack of overtrading is because of sort of that Vanguard ethos?
think there certainly are population skews towards more of a long-term orientation, though I would suggest that if you looked at financial advisors as well, whose assets aren't custodied here but whom we interact with quite a bit, you know, by and large what we see is those investors tend to be very strategic in their asset allocations and less tactical and trading-oriented. So I think by and large this idea of ETFs are used for trading is overblown. It's not really the preponderance of the buying basis behavior. But for those investors who do trade a lot, the ETF is a great structure for that because they're not socializing their trading costs in the mutual fund. Rather, they're bearing all those costs in the form of spread or formally in the case of commissions.
All right. Lastly here, I have to ask you about non-transparent ETFs because we spent a lot of time covering this topic over the past several weeks. I'm sure you're well aware that the SEC has now given approval or preliminary approval to five different non-transparent structures. If you don't mind commenting, I'd love to hear Vanguard's perspective on this.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty exciting development for sponsors in the industry, particularly active firms who haven't been very involved in the ETF marketplace for the last decade or so. But I think the devil's going to be in the details in terms of how these structures actually function in the marketplace. How well do they trade? Is the liquidity there? Is there any kind of particular nuance that investors need to keep in mind as they consider buying those products? But I think that the biggest issue will be investor demand.
Mm-hmm.
We know the challenges that active equity has had over the last 10 to 15 years in terms of cash outflows, and putting an active equity structure into the ETF structure. It's not clear to me that that's necessarily going to solve for those challenges that active managers have had. I think the same formula that's led to successful active equity strategies in mutual funds is going to apply in ETFs, which is you need to have a quality manager with a clear strategy and low cost. And if you have that and you have a long time horizon, these potentially could work. But as we know, not a lot of active managers have kind of delivered on those. So I think if these structures come out and they have some of those facets to it, and oh, by the way, good performance, then perhaps there'll be demand, but time will tell.
And I'm going to ask you the same question I've been asking everybody. Do you have a better name for this category besides non-transparent ETFs?
Yeah, I think that's probably as descriptive as their adjective as I could come up with. Perhaps semi-transparent for some of the structures would be another way to describe. They are nuanced relative to the obviously the current offering in the ETF marketplace, but non-transparent or semi-transparent, it's probably indicative of ultimately what those structures are trying to deliver.
How important do you think transparency is within whether we look at mutual funds or ETFs? And of course, Vanguard's a little unique in that you have a share class structure. So the Vanguard ETFs only disclose holdings every 30 days, which is different than other ETFs that are out on the market. But I guess my question is, you know, where does this fall on sort of the due diligence checklist for the end investor, that transparency?
Yeah, I think for us, you know, we think about the transparency of our index products as one where we're revealing holdings on a monthly basis that gives investors plenty of information to kind of understand what their exposures are. And then we publish baskets of the underlying securities we hold in those ETFs so that market makers can hedge quote our products appropriately in the marketplace. And so as a result, you see very tight spreads on the vast majority of our lineup. In terms of transparency for an active offer, I can see the argument for why an active manager wouldn't necessarily want to reveal their holdings in the marketplace. However, I can also see the argument of a market maker saying, well, I, in order for me to kind of hedge my risk appropriately, I need to have a little more informational content. And so I think what you might end up seeing here is that across these different structures, different levels of spreads, maybe for comparable products, because of the level of risk that a market maker might be taking on by having some or incomplete information on one of these strategies.
Well, Rich, if you can't tell, for whatever reason, this space just fascinates me. I can't wait to see how it plays out as we head to 2020. Such an interesting area. We'll have to leave it there. Always appreciate the time. Thank you for joining me this week.
Thanks so much, Nate.
That was Rich Powers, head of ETF product management at Vanguard. All right, our last guest this week is Todd Rosenbluth, Senior Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA, who is one of the world's leading independent investment research providers. And Todd covers the ETF space as well as anyone. Now, Todd also happens to be a great friend of the show. And so because of that, he gets his own walk-up music. He has his own intro, which interestingly, he actually played a pivotal role in creating this, as you'll hear. So let's chat with CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth.
When our top-rated analytical team looks under the ETF hood, we think Boeing, Intel, Visa, and Walmart are still looking pretty good.
Todd, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me this week.
Thanks, Nate. I appreciate my own walk-up music, a flashback to Inside ETFs, which is coming up in a month.
Yeah, have you been in the lab working on anything new, a new wrap for Inside ETFs here later in January? We have to make sure to keep your intro fresh and innovative.
Well, we'll certainly keep something in mind so you can be able to have when we do the 2020 version of the ETF Prime meet CFRA. So I know we're going to talk about some of the great products that have come to market. I think how I end up pitching my ETF of 2019 will relate to how that what that product is and if it needs any extra oomph behind it. You know, I chose a relatively boring, as Eric Balchunas might say, plain vanilla quality at a reasonable price ETF. I needed to jazz it up a little bit or you know, bring a little bit more energy to it. We'll see if the new products live up on their own.
Yeah, you're going to have big shoes to fill with what you did last year. So, look, Todd, a lot I want to get to, but I did first want to ask you about CFRA's acquisition of First Bridge Data back in August, because I've noticed in your research now, it does seem like there's definitely some new ETF data in analytics. Was that a result of the acquisition?
It definitely was. So to just catch folks up, CFRA, as you mentioned, is an independent ETF research provider as well as covering individual stocks. We made an acquisition in August of First Bridge Data, which was a small but growing ETF data provider and analytics provider. It's been a great addition. In 2020, we will be revamping our ETF approach, incorporating our own in-house data. As you mentioned, the commentary that I've been publishing in the last 3 months has really leveraged some of that raw data. I'm a kid in the candy store. You give me raw data that I can play around with and sort. And I think it stands up very well to the tools that are out there from Bloomberg and FactSet and Morningstar and others. You know, we're happy to be part of that mix and give investors and ETF providers and research providers more choice. And I think you'll get to see more as we talk through what's been going on this year.
Well, let's go ahead and do that. And what I thought we might do is first spend a few minutes looking back on the year that was in ETF. So I have a few serious questions and then a few fun ones. And then I thought we could look ahead to ETFs in 2020. I guess first, give me your top two or three ETF stories in 2019. What has stood out to you most this year?
So hands down, this has been the year of fixed income ETFs. We have in December now, there's still more money that has gone into fixed income ETFs than equity ETFs. It's the first time that'll happen in 10 years. If it happens, I think it might happen, and I'm having confidence, and we can perhaps talk more about my confidence level in a moment. We haven't seen that since the Great Financial Crisis. There is more money going into these products, despite the fact that the equity market is up 20% plus, you know, the S&P 500 and other broad indices as well. And as a reminder to the audience, fixed income ETFs is just 20% of the ETF pie, so it really should not be holding its own, except fixed income ETFs really resonating with institutional investors, advisors, retail investors across the board. And that's, you know, we're showing that data. I know others are showing that data too.
No, without question. We actually talked about it earlier in the show with ETF.com's Drew Voros and then Vanguard's Rich Powers, just that, you know, we have seen the S&P 500 up over 25%, but yet we're seeing these record flows into bond ETFs. So I would agree with you. That definitely has to be one of the ETF stories of the year. What else?
Well, so we, about a year ago, I think on your show perhaps, or either soon after we made the prediction, we at CFRA predicted we would have zero fee ETFs. We published some commentary on ETF.com. Folks can find it to see that I'm not just, you know, cherry picking examples, and we did have it. You know, we haven't seen the money flow in to these SoFi ETFs. We also have the first negative fee ETFs from Salt Financial. But we broke the barrier. I think that's a really an interesting and memorable moment in the ETF industry. We didn't have the certain providers like JP Morgan that was coming in with a U.S. equity product go to zero. They went to 2 basis points, which is still phenomenally cheap. It just isn't as cheap as free. But I think demand for low-cost ETFs continues to resonate. We continue to see investor interest in those products in general. And I think over time, we're going to see more money going into these zero and negative fee ETFs. I think we're going to also see more of these products going forward.
Any thoughts on the level of ETF launches and closures this year? I know this has been another story that's been out there. You had a research piece recently where you noted launches have been a bit slower, and we have seen a higher rate of closures. Do you make anything of that?
So I think a couple of things are happening. One is that if you look at the top 4 or 5 providers, iShares has continued to launch products this year. We've had no new Vanguard ETFs, even though we had new products in 2018 tied to active management. I'm sure Rich probably talked about what they have done in the last few years. There's been limited State Street Global Advisor product launches. Invesco just started to launch new products now that they've digested more of the Oppenheimer and Guggenheim lineup. So I think we're seeing it slower at the bigger boys out there, but there's still some innovative products that I think have been coming out either in the mid-size or newly emerging providers. So I do think we're continually seeing products, and 2020 is going to be a really big year. At the risk, I didn't mention in the top stories, but the fact that we're going to have non-transparent active ETFs in 2020, I think we're going to see a lot of providers enter the market with those offerings.
Todd, I'm going to put you on the spot on the topic of ETF launches. Give me 2 or 3 new ETFs that really caught your attention this year. And as always, these aren't investment recommendations, but if you had to pick a couple of ETFs that you just thought were extremely innovative or compelling, unique, what stood out?
So let me give you the tickers of them first, and then in the interest of time, we'll get to as many of those in depth as possible. I realize you've got a long list of questions for me. So RWCD is from Direxion. I'll just simplify it. It's a relative weight cyclical versus defensive ETF. I think the Global X thematic ETF of GXTG, which is an ETF of other ETFs based on theme-based investing, is compelling. And then on my third one, I would put SNPE, which is an ESG product that DWS launched. It's the S&P 500 put through an S&P-based ESG screen. So in the interest of time, I won't go too far in depth, but I think investors have historically wanted to play favoring a certain investment style over another, and RWCD gives you that. We at CFRA think there's a season for cyclicals versus defensive. We happen to be in that season right now, and I think that's a product that is compelling. It's long the cyclical sectors. It's short the more defensive-oriented sectors.
Well, I think that whole suite...
Let me let you into the conversation.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that whole suite is interesting. I think if you look across the ETF landscape and look at product suites that launched in 2019, that direction, relative weight, going long one area, short the other, that has to be at the top of the list in terms of success that we've seen in a product suite. Because there's, what, 10 different ETFs as a part of that?
There's 10 different ETFs. And what is, I think, compelling about it is, one, you can choose which side you want to be on. So we happen to favor cyclical versus defensive. It's a recommendation. But if you wanted to take the other side of that coin, you can do that. Same thing with growth versus value or developed versus emerging markets. So I think it's a very compelling suite that they have, and it's the only ones that allow you to really go long, short, in a compelling way. I'll quickly just do the S&P ESG product. SNPE, it is not the most popular of these new ESG products that have come to market because it's doing it without the same institutional investment backing. And so the assets are still relatively small, but everyone knows of the S&P 500. Everyone is benchmarked to the S&P 500. ESG is going to be a long-term emerging theme. I don't want to debate that with you. Laura did a great job on that a couple of weeks ago. But even if you think that it's a compelling way of doing it, a low-cost way of getting ESG exposure to a benchmark, hard to go wrong with that overall approach.
All right, Todd, before we look ahead to 2020, how about a few of your favorite new ETF ticker symbols? Do you have any new tickers that you just really liked?
So I really like NERD, N-E-R-D.
That was a good one.
It's a video gaming ETF. Some of us, Tom Lydon, Eric Balchunas, Ben Johnson, and Dave Natig and others, we've kind of taken the coin of ETF nerds when we go out and pontificate about what's going on in the marketplace. So I like the NERD overall theme. It's like bringing it back in a favorable way. And I guess the second one is Genome, G-N-O-M, a genomics ETF. I think thematic-based ETFs, you should know exactly what you're getting with the ticker or know enough to decide whether or not you want to dig closer into it. And I think that's a pretty straightforward way of thinking about the genomics space with G-N-O-M, and that's a Global X product. So those are two that caught my eye as I was looking through the launches.
Our guest is CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. Todd, let's pivot and look ahead to next year. What are two or three ETF stories that you're most excited to watch unfold over the next year or so? What's most on your radar?
So I teased a bit the fact that we're going to have non-transparent, actively managed ETFs. I think active equity ETFs is going to be an area of focus. We've seen a few smaller providers or mid-sized providers, Davis funds, for example, or ARC funds that have truly transparent active management. But we've got Fidelity and T. Rowe Price that just got approval. We've got to launch something in 2020. American Century is a strong brand. Legg Mason is going to be doing this with Precidian. And I think we've got Goldman and J.P. Morgan that have active management in the equity space that they're planning to launch products on. These are heavy hitters that have a strong brand. I think it's going to be interesting to see, one, what they launch, and then, two, are they launching products that can be able to resonate with investors? We're relatively bullish on investor demand for this compared to, I think, others within the industry. So that's one key theme. And then quickly, in the interest of time, the Schwab acquisition of TD Ameritrade and what they're doing overall connected to the ETF space is worth paying attention to. Obviously, TD Ameritrade has their own ETF investor education efforts that I think can carry over well. We've got fractional shares that are likely to be coming, and Schwab will be driving that bus. I think Schwab is really a key player in the space to pay attention to. Third most inflows, according to our First Bridge data this year, iShares and Vanguard are way ahead of them, but Schwab is the fifth largest provider, third most inflows. I think they're going to continue to have success.
I guess on a sort of a similar note, any ETF predictions for 2020? Can you maybe offer a couple of, I guess, more reasonable ETF predictions and then maybe a stretch goal, something a bit more outlandish?
So I'm in the more reasonable camp usually, so I do think that regardless of whether or not I'm right, that fixed income ETF flows actually are higher than equity flows. I think we will see that. I actually have a sushi lunch bet with Eric Balchunas tied to this. But I do think we're going to see another record year for inflows for fixed income ETFs. We hit that already. And I think we're going to continue to see money going in December. We'll hit another record. I think demand is going to continue in 2020 from an asset allocation perspective. And then my second prediction, which I don't think, again, is that outlandish, is that Goldman Sachs will join the top 10 among ETF providers.
I agree with that.
Fellow bank of J.P. Morgan. And I'm really just taking the data that we've seen thus far. So J.P. Morgan Chase is the fifth largest inflows this year, behind iShares, Vanguard, Schwab, then First Trust, then J.P. Morgan. Chase is number five. Goldman is number eight on that list. Again, only just over $4 billion in net inflows. It's still relatively small, but I think they're going to continue to punch above their weight. They've got, as I think low-cost ETFs in the hopper, and they've got an advisory part of the business now, and they've got great products as well. So I think those are two things that are going to succeed that's going to succeed with investors. So those are my two relatively comfortable predictions for 2020.
Anything more outlandish that you want to offer?
I think in 2020 we're going to get you on stage with the rest of us pundits because you know your stuff. You obviously show it every week on this show. And we need some regional, you know, we need some Midwestern folks.
That's right. Only if you want to lose, because if I get on stage, I'm winning.
Oh, no, I didn't say you're doing it inside ETF, picking an ETF, but as we do some of these things around the country, you know, we've got an East Coast tilt with Dave and Eric and myself, and we've got Tom and Elizabeth and Matt sometime and the West Coast, and you just have Ben in the middle of the country. And so, you know, in the interest of regional diversity, I think we need to have that as well.
Todd, before I let you go, I think sticking with, or for old time's sake, because I ask you this every time that you're on the show, as we look into 2020, what about a Bitcoin ETF? So we saw WisdomTree launch a Bitcoin product overseas. Will we see a Bitcoin ETF in the U.S. in 2020?
So I don't think we're going to see one in 2020. I think that the regulators have raised enough concerns that are going to be hard for firms, you know, my friend Matt Hogan and his team at Bitwise and others to be able to overcome. But I have to admit, I was surprised. You know, I don't track, you know, Bitcoin potential launches the way that some do, but WisdomTree obviously knows how to get products launched in the United States, you know, whether that's in the hopper for them to be determined. But I just don't think this group of regulators is comfortable, and enough ground is going to be made up between now and 2020. But we'll have likely new membership of the SEC following the election, and perhaps the cards are in favor for that in 2021 and beyond.
Todd, always enjoy whenever you join us. You're one of the best in the ETF business. Really appreciate all of your hard work, and certainly look forward to connecting down at Inside ETFs in January. Thank you, and hope you and your family enjoy the holiday season.
You too, Nate, and to all the listeners, and thanks again for putting on such great educational programming.
Thank you, Todd. That was CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth, and if you're not already doing so, highly recommend following Todd on Twitter. He's at ToddCFRA. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, we would greatly appreciate it if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, Principal's Ed Nini will explain how they're approaching the ETF market, and he'll also spotlight a few Principal ETFs. And then Steve Houston, partner at M Plus Funds, will go in-depth on defined outcome investments. Until then, have a great week, everyone.